Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi, introducing you to new non-fiction books full of original, memorable insights, or OMI, from the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture. In this episode...
My name is Roman Krasnarek, author of The Good Ancestor, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
One of Britain's leading philosophers, if not the leading philosopher, who wants us to embrace our clear and present connection to a future as deep, if not deeper, than the billions of years behind us.
The real problem here is that we colonize the future. We treat it as a dumping ground for ecological degradation and technological risk and nuclear waste, as if there's nobody there.
Roman Krasnarek's work influences the thinking of political reformers and social entrepreneurs around the world. In his latest book, The Good Ancestor, How to Think Long-Term in a Short-Term World, Roman Krasnarek describes a struggle for the human mind, no less, a tug of war between forces of short-term, opportunistic, impulsive thinking, and long-term, deep-time empathy for generations to come. We are, he says, like colonialists pillaging the future from our unborn children. On that jaunty note, Roman, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you for that jaunty introduction and that kind of depressing quote, but hopefully we can move beyond it.
But the book is one of hope, and you preface the book with a note about COVID-19 in March 2020 and how we're living in an opportunity to reset the future. Do you agree with Milton Friedman, who said only a crisis produces real change? And if so, are we in that crisis opportunity now?
Well, I certainly believe Milton Friedman's general view of history. I don't agree with all his economic ideas, but that general view that crisis does produce major transformation in political systems and economic systems. I do believe we're in one of those moments now, but the thing about crises is that it's a bit like a devil's fork. They can go in different directions. So though I could look back to the Second World War, for example, and the end of the Second World War was a moment of, you know, out of that crisis, came incredible pioneering long-term institutions. You know, for example, the World Health Organization or the European Union or, you know, the National Health Service in the UK. But you could go back 10 years before to something like, for example, the Great Depression. And that brought forth very different responses to the crisis. You know, in Scandinavia, they went towards social democracy. In Germany, they went towards fascism. So, and I think this moment we're in now can also go in different directions. And for someone like me, who's interested in how do we extend our time horizons and overcome that insane short-termism where politicians can't see past the next elections or businesses past the next quarter report and we can't stop clicking the buy now button, well, we could be going towards a more positive long-term future or a negative one. I mean, just think of, you know, some countries where their political leaders have grabbed the emergency powers under COVID-19 and don't want to let go of them. There may be an authoritarian residue. On the other hand, there's a lot of grassroots political organizing going on at this moment, which has partly come out of Black Lives Matter or even WhatsApp group on our local streets where there's a lot of community activism. So I think it is a moment of crisis, but it's up to us to see where we take it.
Yeah, you position the book incredibly clearly in time and a timeline. You stretch backwards billions of years and to the dawn of mankind. And we've come a long way, haven't we, since the Middle Ages, as well as society. People living longer, healthier, who knows, even happier lives, from the agricultural through the industrial and electronic age. Is there an argument that things broadly will just carry on getting better?
Well, that is very much the kind of Steven Pinker view of the world that he wrote about in his book Enlightenment Now, this idea that, you know, we've had great progress in the last few hundred years, which I think is true in many ways. The things you're saying, you know, that dealing with poverty and inequality and, you know, longevity, where we've been getting an education and so on. On the other hand, I don't think there's any good reasons to think that is necessarily going to continue. In fact, quite the opposite. All the signals are telling us that we are overshooting critical boundaries of Earth system stability in terms of biodiversity loss, CO2 emissions, ocean acidification. In that area, there's incredible long-term crises already here and will be keep coming our way, because that CO2 is going to stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. And then we're also facing crises coming from new technologies, from artificial intelligence, for example, AI-controlled lethal autonomous weapons, or the threat not just of pandemics, but of genetically engineered pandemics. And there's a kind of irony here, because in a way, there's an urgency to long-term thinking. We need it right here, right now. And, you know, the way I think about it, as you signal in your introduction there, the real problem here is that we colonize the future. We treat it as a dumping ground for ecological degradation and technological risk and nuclear waste, as if there's nobody there. And it's a bit like the way when Britain colonized Australia in the 18th and 19th centuries, they drew on a legal doctrine now known as terra nullius, nobody's land, the idea that there were no indigenous people, so they could just nick it. And I think we're now in an age of tempus nullius. We see the future as nobody's time, as if it's devoid of people. Yet, of course, there are the billions upon billions of people who will inhabit the future waiting there, but they've got no voice in our politics today. They don't have a voice at the ballot box. They don't have a voice at the marketplace either. So there's a struggle for intergenerational justice to be had.
Yeah, you use that phrase in the book, intergenerational justice. Obviously, there's a huge moral philosophy, a thread of that running, and your moral philosophy running through the book. But if we've evolved over millions of years, we're obviously the smartest species on the planet.
So we think.
But that's the way we position ourselves. That's the way we frame ourselves in the universe. But we can think ahead. We started thinking ahead a few hundred thousand years ago, inventing, collaborating. So if we're so smart, why are we so susceptible to pathological, as you put it, short-term thinking and the tyranny of now? Are we just not as smart as we think we are?
It's a really great question. And I think it ultimately goes to the way the human brain works. And I think we tend to think of ourselves in general as very much driven in terms of human nature by short-term rewards and instant gratification, you know, meeting the next deadline and buying fast food and answering the latest text. And that short-term part of our brain, what I call the marshmallow brain, which I name after the famous marshmallow test from the 1960s, where kids had a marshmallow put in front of them. If they could resist eating it for 15 minutes, they were rewarded with a second marshmallow, and the majority of kids couldn't resist the snack. That's one part of our brains, which is very ancient. It's sort of 80 million years old. We share it with rats. But we also have this other part of our brain, which is the long-term part, which lives above our eyes in a bit called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And that's a new part of our brains. And we do have an extraordinary capacity to think long-term compared to a lot of creatures. So a chimpanzee can look forward a bit. I mean, they'll take a stick from a tree and strip off the leaves to make a tool to stick in a termite hole, but they'll never make a dozen of those tools and put them aside for next week. But that's exactly what human beings do. And we're much better at that kind of long-term thinking than we really recognize. That's how we, you know, save for our pensions, or that's how we even write song lists for our own funerals. That's how we built the Great Wall of China. That's how we voyaged into space. So we have this, what I think of as an acorn brain, that competes with the marshmallow brain. But to actually answer your question, I think the problem is that our institutions, our public institutions, have been designed around short-termism and not around amplifying the long-term brain. I mean, if you think about the way our politics works, you know, electoral cycles, you know, every few years, every 4 years, every couple of years with Congress in the US, you know, politicians can't see very far. They can't even see past the next tweet. And partly there's technology, of course, which is making us respond much more quickly. We're caught in 24/7 news cycles. So the thing about the long-term part of the brain is that it is new, only a couple of million years old, and we just haven't got very good at using it yet. It's our short-term brain is dominant. So we've got to, in a way, push ourselves to become part-time residents of the future, use that ability that we've got.
And assess the risk, I suppose, because that's what we do as we get older. We learn to build consequences into our actions. And you quote Nick Bostrom, the risk scholar, you call him, and the author of the Goat. Is that how he refers to himself now, the risk scholar?
I call him a risk scholar. I think there's a bunch of them who are interested particularly in existential risks, like risks from new technology.
Ah, okay. And well, yeah, so he's the author of Superintelligence. So that's the go-to book on AI and the risks of AI, isn't it? And he has all sorts of metaphors like paperclips on the future taking over and robots taking over. But you spoke to him and he says that we have a 1 in 6 chance of not making it to the end of the century. But even when you read that, and I'm as guilty as this as anyone, you go, oh, 6 to 1, that's not bad. I'll take those odds. And you think, but then you're sort of deferring responsibility to the odds. Do you know what I mean? You sort of detach yourself. And so we must fight against that, I suppose. And I wonder, are we the worried well? Because there are people all over the world living week to week, day to day, hour to hour even. And is long-term thinking the luxury of a privileged few?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the 1 in 6 thing, I mean, that's just a roll of a dice. I mean, if you knew that you were going to get knocked over and killed by but killed by a car, if you walked outside, if there's a 1 in 6 chance of that, you probably wouldn't go outside. And certainly these existential risks thinkers like Nick Bostrom or another guy called Toby Ord, who's written a very good book called The Precipice, you know, they think they're these great threats, particularly from artificial intelligence. But I sort of think that threats from climate change are equally, if not more, stark, because exactly partly because they are hitting people right now, particularly in developing countries. And on that question of, well, is long-term thinking really a luxury for, you know, the middle classes in wealthy countries who aren't just scrabbling away trying to deal with their day-to-day problems, whether it's feeding themselves and their children or finding a job or finding somewhere to live? Actually, the curious thing is that it's often people who are in positions of powerlessness or in the social margins who are really engaged with long-term thinking and intergenerational justice. So you might find an aristocrat who cares about the long-term, but really only passing on their family home, their manor house to their kids, and they don't have a very broad view of intergenerational justice. Yet you can look to something like indigenous cultures, for example, in North America, the Native American idea of seventh generation decision making, which is very common amongst, for example, the Iroquois peoples today, this idea of making decisions, community decisions based on its impact 7 generations ahead. Well, that's really long-term thinking, and it's not coming from a powerful, privileged part of society. Or in Maori culture in New Zealand, there's this concept of whakapapa, which is their word for genealogy. It's the idea that we're all in a great chain of life connecting the past, the present, and the future. And, you know, who are we to break that chain with our ecological blindness and deadly technologies? And then the third thing I just say there is that look at Black Lives Matter. Really interesting that some of the key ways people talk about it are in terms of intergenerational justice. So there's another great book written by Leila Saad called Me and White Supremacy. And she's someone who started something called the Good Ancestor Podcast. And what she's talking about is how the intergenerational or the racial injustice built into criminal justice systems and other public institutions will be passed through the generations onto the children and grandchildren unless something's done about it. So actually, it turns out that this long-term thinking theme is something that touches many more people than you might think.
Once you get into the topic and start seeing people who shared the same brain and neural networks as you, who had the same concerns hundreds, thousands of years ago, and then you extrapolate that into the future and then look at it. I think it's metaphors and language which help. I was interviewing Lily Cole the other day, and she points out in her book, or she quotes someone who points out in her book, the fact that the generation that will see the next century in is already on the planet biologically in eggs, unfertilized eggs in young people. And that's incredible when you start thinking they're already, you know, the next people of the next century are already with us.
Yeah, so that's an absolutely brilliant thought, actually. And it really connects something I think about a lot, which is, you know, I sometimes imagine my 11-year-old daughter as a 90-year-old, and I imagine her on her 90th birthday, and then someone placing a tiny baby into her arms, which is her first great grandchild, and thinking that that little baby could live well into the 22nd century. So, you know, the future isn't science fiction. It's an intimate family fact. And as Lily Cole's pointing out there, it's even kind of inside us. It's all sort of ready to come forth. So I think that's a way of trying to make that connection with the future, because often the future can seem just so distant, so uncertain, that you might ask, you know, what has it really got to do with me?
It's about bringing it home and getting it in front of people, isn't it? And helping people to understand. I spoke also to Jonathan Porritt, and hope crops up a lot in book titles at the moment, nonfiction book titles. You know, Rutger Bregman, Hopeful History, and Jonathan Porritt's book, Hope in Hell. And hope is something that you deal with philosophically through the book versus optimism. Now, what's the difference for you between hope and optimism?
Right. Well, that's a distinction which I have to admit that I've stolen from the literary theorist Terry Eagleton, who draws that distinction between optimism and hope. And what he says is that optimism is about having a kind of glass half full view of the world, always seeing the positive, even in spite of the evidence. And I think he would agree with this, that that kind of view is something that can induce apathy, induce inaction, because we think, well, everything's going to be fine. Hope, on the other hand, is the recognition that you may not be successful in what you're trying to achieve, but you're going to go for it anyway, despite the odds, because you really believe in the values behind it. And that's certainly how I think about the struggles of long-term thinking and winning the battle against our colonization of the future. This is a hell of a struggle, right? I mean, it's about, for example, how do we reinvent our political institutions to make them long-term? How do you get companies to see beyond the quarterly report or what the shareholders are driving them towards? These are colossal questions but I think, you know, I have faith in history, recognizing that human beings have been able to change the world, whether it's the struggles against slavery that began in the 18th century or the struggles against colonialism in itself. And we're pretty good at dealing with crises. Think about after Hurricane Katrina or after 9/11, people on the ground really jumped into action. Even after COVID-19 here, you know, in the UK, I think members of the public were taking it more seriously than the government was at many times and were pushing the government to take it more seriously. So we do have a capacity to respond to crisis.
The solutions that you're talking about, I mean, we're restricted really by, and we're, our fate's sealed by the ideas and the ideologies of the government, those who run the economy, run our lives. How do we walk the path of the good ancestor when the road is nasty, brutish and short? You suggest taxing short-term gains on the stock market. That sounds brilliant, but can you really see a Boris Johnson or a Donald Trump or any electable politician at the moment backing that as a policy?
The interesting thing about that idea of, you know, taxing share trades based on how long you've held the shares for, it's actually already happening in some countries like France, where there are higher taxes on short-term trades, on algorithmic share trading. So it's something I think it's possible and that we could push for, but it's not probably going to happen under the current government in the UK or in the United States. But there are amazing movements of people in many countries trying to push for more long-term structures in our economies and in our politics. So even a very reasonably close by example, in Wales, they've got a Future Generations Commissioner whose job it is to scrutinize public policy for its impact on people 20 or 30 years ahead. Now, as the commissioner herself will admit, she doesn't have as much power as she'd really like or really need. And in fact, in the UK at the moment, there is a campaign called Today for Tomorrow for the whole of the UK to have a Future Generations Commissioner that's got a lot more teeth, that can hold public bodies to account for failing to deal with child poverty or meeting carbon emission targets. And then there are really good examples in other countries to draw on. So in Japan, they've got this brilliant movement called Future Design, and it's a way of making decisions in towns and cities. And they invite local residents, like a kind of citizen assembly model, to come to these meetings. They split them into two groups. And the first group are told that they're residents from the future. And the second group are told to imagine themselves as residents from the year 2060. And they're given these beautiful ceremonial kimonos to wear to aid their imaginative leap. And it turns out those residents from 2060 come up with much more radical policies in environmental policy and healthcare and education and so on. And they're even willing to pay, for example, higher water rates to improve the water system and water infrastructure, whereas the group from the present day, they want to have their water taxes reduced. So there's real models out there that we could be spreading all over the place.
And long-termism isn't the preserve of hopeful moral philosophers, is it? It's the markets, and capitalism deals in long-term stocks and trades and greed, for want of a better word. I just wonder, the really interesting side to this as well, if we were trying to have a carrot or give people something in the present, and I love the idea of the, you know, learning from the past, living in the present or sensing the present and imagining the future together. I think that's what makes human beings different to any other living species on the earth. But is there a way, Roman, do you think that people could be rewarded immediately by thinking long term? I.e., does it make one feel better? Are there, because the way the society you're describing excites me, and it's one that I would like to imagine. But how do we get people rewarded in the present moment?
I mean, I definitely agree with you that in terms of human psychology, if you're going to motivate people to engage with the long term, it's helpful to have some short term rewards along the way. So there's a really interesting question there that you raise, which is, well, what might those short term rewards be? I think on a sort of public level, someone like the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales, her name's Sophie Howe, what she focuses on is policies that help both people today and in the future. So, you know, she has championed, you know, renewable energy and more public transport and all those kind of things rather than just extending motorways. And for her, that's an obvious win for current generations, but it's good for creating a more sustainable economy. But I think on the individual level, we have to recognize that, firstly, if you're thinking about future generations, you're thinking about your children's lives or your grandchildren or nephews and nieces in the future, that's a really important relationship to a lot of people, to know that you're doing something for those young people who are going to grow up in the future. And I think that gives us a kind of existential nourishment, because we all care about relations, but we need to think about our relations not just across space, but through time. And I think another way to think about this is, look, if you're interested in long-term thinking, you don't have to just think about time, you can also think about place. So let me just tell you what I mean by that, that if we want to survive on this planet over the long term, there's one thing that we need to do, which is to not foul the nest. We can't live outside the boundaries of the planet. We can't keep growing and growing in terms of our material use and fossil fuel use and so on, because we're living beyond the means of the one and only planet we know that sustains life. So we've got to live within its boundaries. And one of the best ways to do that is to care about the living world, to fall in love with a meadow or a river or a mountain. So it's long-term thinking in that sense is about place as much as time. And I think that's something that a lot of people really understand. That's why they are into movements such as rewilding. That's why they will plant an acorn in the ground and know that that tree will never mature within their own lifetime, but it's going to provide shade for somebody else. So I think we can all tap into those things that when we're searching for meaning and purpose in life. And yeah, it's different from getting the quick win of pressing the buy now button, but it is a deep form of existential nourishment.
I really can empathize with you on that. When I go walking in the woods with my dog and I look at trees that are hundreds, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years old, and I think of people walking past that in their, you know, their plus fours or their smocks, or even, you know, early hunter gatherers around the swamps, and think that these were people who walked this same and saw the same thing. And in the future, when I'm gone, that tree will still be there.
That's right. And I think we all connect with this, that famous story from the 1950s called The Man Who Planted Trees, about a shepherd who, you know, every day put a few acorns into the ground, and after a few decades had grown a vast oak forest. And I think that inspires people. We all kind of get it. I mean, this country, you know, Britain has 10 million gardeners or something like that, who listen to Gardeners' Question Time like a religious sermon. But they feel, I think, that connection with deeper time, looking at an ancient tree, going to your local churchyard and seeing that yew tree that's been there for 1,000 years, that sense of deep time, and realizing that we as human beings are just an eye blink in that great story of life and cosmic history, gives us a little bit of perspective. And I think it can help us recognize that, well, yeah, who are we to break that chain? Why don't we try and contribute to, you know, a longer sense of the now, a now which is not just about seconds and minutes, but to borrow a phrase from the musician Brian Eno, a longer sense of now, which is about decades and centuries and millennia.
Let's talk about Brian Eno for a second and his sense of time and the physical manifestation of the ideas we're talking about. You're a research fellow for the Long Now Foundation, is that right?
That's right.
And is the foundation behind the 10,000-year clock project in Texas? Is that right?
That's right. So the Long Now Foundation started about 20 years ago. And Brian Eno, in fact, is one of the board members and in fact, named it the Long Now Foundation. And they have this many projects, but the one of the most fundamental ones they have is called the 10,000-year clock that you just mentioned, which is a clock being built as we speak inside a limestone mountain in the Texas desert, which is designed to last for 10 millennia and stay accurate for that long, at least. And so you'll be able to visit it by hiking through the desert for a couple of days and then walking up the side of the mountains, up steps, cut into the edge of the mountain, each of them representing a million years of geological time. So it's kind of like a secular altarpiece to a long-term thinking civilization to help us think about our responsibility to future generations. But in a way, in the arts, there are lots of really interesting deep time projects like that. Another one I really love is from the Scottish artist Katie Patterson, called The Future Library. And this is a 100-year art project which began in 2014. And every year for 100 years, a famous writer is depositing a book in the Future Library, which will remain completely secret and unread until the year 2114, when the 100 books will be printed on paper made from 1,000 trees which have been planted in the forest outside Oslo. The first writer to give a book was Margaret Atwood. Elif Shafak and others have given books. And if you think about it, Margaret Atwood is never going to meet those readers in 2114. She'll be long gone and she'll never see that book published. And what an incredible legacy gift to the future. And I think that can make us all ask, you know, what gifts might we want to leave to the future holders, the descendants that, who we're never going to meet, the universal strangers of tomorrow?
It's an amazing image, isn't it? And books do that, what Tim O'Reilly calls passing fire from mind to mind through generations. And that's when you think about it, we were just talking earlier at the beginning, before we started our pod today, just looking into books and the minds of people who have not only written the books, but who have read the books. I love going in secondhand bookshops and looking at, you know, dedications and notes in the front of secondhand books to people who are long gone, but their lives, you know, that moment that they were sharing, an intimate, sentimental moment, I find sometimes more interesting than the books themselves.
Well, I love that that phrase of Tim O'Reilly's of passing the fire is absolutely brilliant. And I mean, to me, it links to this idea of an intergenerational golden rule. So, you know, the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Well, why not? Let's think about that through time. So let's treat future generations how we would have wanted to be treated ourselves. And I think of that as like passing on not a golden rule, but a golden baton from generation to generation, a little bit like passing on a fire, I guess, like an Olympic torch. And I think that gives us that sense of legacy connection with the future, because, you know, why should we treat the future differently than how we'd want to be treated ourselves?
And that sense of being connected to the past and the present and the future gives one a real sense of purpose and awareness of life. So I think that is really, if we can achieve that, it's a spiritual thing, isn't it? It's an awareness of who you are in context of the past and the future. So if we need a reward at all, I'm not talking about a material reward, I'm talking about a feeling of well-being.
Yeah, funny, actually, just as you said that, I was remembering how I once met this New Zealand Maori activist, a legal activist called Julia Vaiputi. And she was talking about how when she's giving a public talk, for example, she feels the living and the dead and the unborn all there in the room with her, this sense that her past generations and her future generations are all there together. And she said, you know, for people living in Western culture, highly individualistic Western culture, she said, well, I kind of feel sorry for you that you're so unconnected. I think we can all try and make that effort to connect with future generations. And I think that spiritual aspect is really interesting, because actually, if you think about, for example, the world's hundreds of thousands of environmental organizations that have emerged over the last half century, they all are secretly, in a way, spiritual bodies, in the sense that they are all about worshiping Mother Earth, worshiping Gaia in some sense. They may not say it like that in their articles of association or on their homepages, but really they have a sort of sense of the sacredness of the earth as something that should be preserved for future people and, you know, in and of itself. And I think there's something kind of spiritual there, actually, in a way, even though I'm a totally kind of secular person. And in fact, I was talking about this with Richard Dawkins, who in a way is maybe the world's most famous atheist. And I said to him, I said, look, don't you think at this moment of ecological crisis and climate crisis that there might be a value in encouraging people to have a spiritual connection with the living world in some way as a way of preserving it for the long term? And I really thought that he was going to be quite dismissive of me, of that question. And he was really interesting. He said, well, look, I prefer to make the scientific arguments about taking action on climate change. But he said that, you know, I can see almost an instrumental reason for why one might want to promote a kind of spiritual connection with the future and with the living planet as a way of galvanizing people into action. So I think it's really interesting that even someone who's quite a rational person sees the need for some deeper connection there.
It's in all of us, isn't it? Whether we're atheist or agnostic or, you know, or we have a religion, it's we all walk the same earth and breathe the same air and need to feel like our life is worth something. Roman, I'm ironically looking for an oversimplified quick fix here, an antidote, a philosophical silver bullet to the problem of decolonizing our minds. If you say, you kind of, the summary to the book slightly is to the big challenge is one of the mind, that we need to decolonize them and that we will decolonize the future. How do we as individuals, if we do one thing today or tomorrow, if we have one thought, what should it be to get us on the path of the good ancestor?
Well, I can tell you what my partner and I did at the end of last year, at the time of the last UK general election. if you can cast your mind back that far, we decided to give our votes in the election to our 11-year-old twins as a birthday present. So we sat around the kitchen table, debated the party manifestos and even how the electoral system worked, and they then told us where to put the X on the ballot sheet. So in fact, I'd love to see a movement where parents and particularly grandparents gave their votes to their children. If it's in your power to do that, that is really starting to give a voice to the next generation.
Roman, thank you very much. Thanks for sharing your OMI with Bokomi today.
Thanks so much, Richard, for having me on.
Roman's book, The Good Ancestor, How to Think Long-Term in a Short-Term World, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction before anyone else, sign up to our monthly Most Wanted email at bookomi.com. Bookomi subscribers can register to take part in our live podcast recordings. Meanwhile, if you enjoyed this Bookomi pod, please let us know by following or subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe and remember, the future started yesterday. Bye for now.